Hello. It's good to talk to you. We were considering last week the roots of the Fourth Amendment's constitutional theory about the limitation of search and seizure coming directly from a sentence-focused understanding of the nature of the single idea that the Fourth Amendment comprises. The key elements in this understanding are the nature of the list, the persons, houses, papers, and effects, as the indicia of the sort of material for which the rights of the people against unreasonable search and seizure attach. The idea of the built-in understanding that reasonable searches and seizures among the persons, houses, papers, and effects are not somehow stopped by the people's rights. And the understanding of the specificity requirement in the requirement for warrants supported by oath or affirmation issued by magistrates on the particulars of the places to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. The attitude of the First Congress we have not fully discussed yet. And to do so, we need to back up a little bit in our context to the recognition that the Federal Bill of Rights, upon which the First Congress is acting, is understood both in the context of the state constitution making of the 1770s, that is, the constitutional position of the British North Americans, which led to the breakup of the first British Empire, a position which hinges upon both the effort to entrench rights against a sovereign parliament, and on the other hand, the recognition of the first Congress in the aftermath of the making and the ratification of the federal constitution, that the imperial layer of government, the one which replaces, if you like, the first British Empire, in helping the states previously independent and now coalesced into a second federal effort, the Articles of Confederation having proved at least to the portions of American society that fronted the making of the Constitution of 1787, a second attempt at replacing the first British Empire's role above the states in the North American power system with a new federal government, imperial in nature. We need to think a little more about that in a moment. Imperial in nature, that is intended to be empowered with military force for the purpose of possessing the continent. Thinking continentally, in John Adams' phrase, is, after all, what the First Congress is most explicitly doing. The First Congress's view of the Bill of Rights is of the restraints to be imposed on the imperial part of American government, the one which they feel as above the states in the hierarchical sense, but distant from the people in what is more importantly their relevant sense. That the people of the United States, having attempted to form a more perfect union, are still fundamentally citizens of their states, often in this era referred to in the discussion in the United States Congress and elsewhere as their countries, When I speak of my country, sir, said John Randolph of Roanoke, Thomas Jefferson's cousin, as so many people are, in the Congress of 1800, when I speak of my country, sir, I mean the sovereign state of Virginia, says Randolph, and after all, he's not the only one. So the making of the federal constitution and the opposition opposed to it by anti-federalist forces in 1787, 1788, has left behind, as part of the principle of the making of the Bill of Rights, the recognition that what the Bill of Rights restrains is the empire. The army for the possession of the continent, its federal structure at the borders, its foreign relations, its customs, and its associated machinery of collection and justice, but not a unified national government by any means, and one of which it is appropriate for the people of the states to be in some sense afraid. With respect to the Fourth Amendment, of course, this is directly expressed, as it is in the Third Amendment's quartering provisions and in the requirement against takings of property without due process of law. What is being expressed is the recognition that a government powerful enough to make a more perfect union and to possess the continent is powerful enough to be dangerous to citizens, even if the fundamental design of the constitutional order is intended to separate the federal layer of government from the citizenry. This is both a protection for the intentionally conservative aspects of the federal government, its prohibition, for example, on the influencing of state contract law, or the principle against takings in the Fifth Amendment, that is to say, against the possibility that a despotism reared on populism might actually affront or destroy the established orders of state governments, a thing which is always worrisome in those places in the British North American dominions, like, say, New York, which are subject to that form of social turmoil. The provision made in the Fourth Amendment concerning searches and seizures is, as I was explaining last time, about thuggery, about the possibility of the despotic use of the forces of the federal government, including, for example, its customs service, in much the same way that the British North Americans had experienced despotic thuggery from the first British Empire with respect, again, to questions of customs and trade collection and the inevitable friction between the American smugglers and the British merchants after the end of the Continental War against France. The impulse to the control of thuggery by the federal government in searching and seizing is addressed, it should be recalled now, only to a previously non-existent federal bureaucracy. The conscription of the state law enforcement structures into that system, that is, the federal government's taking over and using state officials to serve its warrants and conduct its searches and its seizures, is a distant but definable concern. Hence the propositions that constrain the extent to which the political economy of thuggery can be varied in the federal government's direction, regardless of what Congress may at any moment be inclined to do, or whatever it is that the soon-to-be-existing federal courts, with their predictable interest in the federal revenue, might bring about. So the sentence, that is the Fourth Amendment, the single idea that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, etc., etc. The sentence which establishes the right of the people within the new, more perfect union against certain actions by federal officers conducted in violation of what have come to be seen after 17th and 18th century English constitutional developments as unreasonable searches and seizures, and which are supported by the British North American experience of the, to their mind, aggressively unconstitutional law enforcement by royal officials in the British North American colonies after 1763, the scope of their understanding specifically limits what they are constantly afraid is the oncoming federal despotism of some union run not by George Washington but by Alexander Hamilton or Donald Trump, that is, by power-seeking, corrupt, or merely demagogic leadership possessed of the power of the Federal Union and its army to destroy liberty and to upset the social order. For this purpose, I suppose we can say that the Fourth Amendment served adequately well in an empire from 1790 to 1900, which had very little federal law enforcement bureaucracy in it for the Fourth Amendment to constrain. It is not, in this sense, surprising that the question how to make the Fourth Amendment bite in the constraint of government power arises substantially only after 1900. Weeks against United States' declaration of the exclusionary rule, which is the primary mechanism of enforcement of the Fourth Amendment, those violations which occur through the unreasonable searching and seizing occurring in places or at times in which the warrant and specificity requirements have somehow failed in their task of cabining the discretion of law enforcement, arise in the Supreme Court at roughly the same time that a federal law enforcement structure is finally beginning to occur. We take for granted now the vast prosecutorial power of the Federal Justice Department and the extraordinary dedication and effort that is contained in the U.S. Attorney's offices. But it is important to remember that the federal legal and prosecutorial service of the United States from 1789 until 1912 was all embodied in lawyers in private practice operating as U.S. attorney in the federal judicial districts as part of their practice. The government was merely one among the clients of one or another lawyer everywhere in the United States Empire until the second decade of the 20th century. The first full-time United States attorney in any district of the United States, you might expect, was in the Southern District of New York, that is in New York City. Emory Buckner was appointed to that position and confirmed by the United States Senate in 1912. So you could think of the exclusionary rule declared by in 1914 by the United States Supreme Court in U.S. against Weeks. You can think of the exclusionary rule as essentially created at the moment that the federal prosecutorial service was professionalized for the first time, the exclusionary rule in the United States courts prohibiting the introduction of evidence seized as a result of unconstitutional, unreasonable search and seizure dates from the moment at which we also begin to have a Justice Department professionalizing its prosecutorial service, and within a decade of the effort for the first time to create a federal police force in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is essentially, as you know, coeval with the prohibition experiment in the United States. It is drug law that produces federal policing, and it is federal policing and federal prosecution professionalization which produce the concern with searching and seizing and the possibility of of reasonably inexpensive federal despotism that generates the effort to make something of the Fourth Amendment in an operational sense at the trial end, where the exclusionary rule begins to do the work of offering an opportunity for the adjudication of questions about the reasonableness of federal search and seizure. Now, therefore, we need also to recognize that the Fourth Amendment doctrine we possess from that beginning of the exclusionary rule in Weeks until the decision in Mapp against Ohio half a century later is still the law of the restraint of a particular enforcement system, the federal police and prosecutorial system, which is itself a tiny fraction, distant from the population in many of the respects that the framers of the United States Constitution expected. It was, again, prohibition, the beginning of significant drug law for enforcement in the United States, which put the federal policing system in direct relationship to ordinary citizens, and which puts the knock on the door, the federal knock on the door, as a real possibility in the lives of people who would otherwise have experienced only the law enforcement activity of local police under state government control and state court jurisdiction. For which reason, the primary question at stake in the world of the federal Fourth Amendment before Mapp is really the question, what happens when federal authority seeks to introduce in federal courts evidence arrived at by the searching and seizing activity of state police? To which the answer officially given by the Supreme Court in Wolf against Colorado is that the Fourth Amendment has no role to play in excluding such evidence from the federal courts if it was given to federal police or prosecutors on a silver platter, as Wolf expresses it. This means that the Fourth Amendment fails under 20th century conditions to constrain anybody very much, so long as it assumes that the limited powers of thuggery of the United States government are the only powers that it can possibly constrain. Once the gift of evidence to the federal authorities by state authorities or third parties unaffiliated with any government is ruled outside the range of the exclusionary rule, then the promise made to the ear of the Fourth Amendment is broken to the hope. And it is this immense change which Mapp against Ohio, by incorporating the Fourth Amendment protections into the Due Process Clause of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, overturns. Before we come to the conditions of, that we might think of as the modern Fourth Amendment, a form of restraint on searching and seizing actually applicable to some substantial portion of the society's searching and seizing, we need to back up again and think about the relationship between third parties and criminal defendants. The primary weakness of the Fourth Amendment, as we shall see this week and next, under 21st century conditions, when we are talking about the searching and seizing of information rather than persons, houses, and papers, when the primary weakness of the Fourth Amendment is its extraordinarily well-adapted meaning to 18th century minds. It's about places, you see. That idea of the breaking in and the taking people out or carting evidence away, that the place is ultimately searched and is ultimately named in the warrant, and that it is the place that is protected against thuggery, that idea, which we can do no better, I think, than to refer to as the placiness of the Fourth Amendment, is also a line which distinguishes the personal affront from the conduct of government operation. The barrels of molasses, untaxed because unofficially crossing borders between the islands and the mainland of North America, which are the flashpoint of concern for British North Americans in the 18th century, the sugar that motivates the general assistance writs against which James Otis and other lawyers of 1760s Massachusetts threw themselves into court, the forms of misbehavior which so inflamed the politics of British North America from 1765 until the opening of the so-called revolution, the issues that present themselves are about objects lying in warehouses. Not necessarily official warehouses. They may be smugglers' caches and places of hiding, and sometimes the habitations of a John Hancock or a Nicholas Roosevelt, that is, somebody in the business of moving barrels about in trade. But primarily the issue is always the objects of A in the hands of B. And the party whose close is broken, whose locks are trifled with, who must face an officer with a warrant, the party is B rather than A. That is to say, always the question of the unreasonableness of the search and the seizure will arise in a context in which the party whose rights have been offended is not the party who owned the barrels of molasses in the first place. This fact that third parties are served with warrants and must either object to them or permit the searches to occur is the background both to the kinds of disputes which the Fourth Amendment ultimately addresses in the First Congress, and a limitation on its meaning. The principle is not, after all, that it is the owners of property who are primarily offended when an unreasonable search and seizure occurs, or rather, not the owners of the property seized, but rather the party whose warehouse was searched, whose premises are subject to the intrusion of the state, and that party may very well be uninterested in the particulars of the dispute to which the search was merely ancillary. The suppression of evidence, however, is a remedy which occurs not with respect to the party whose premises were searched or invaded, not necessarily with respect to that party, but necessarily with respect to whomever it was who ultimately must sustain the risk of prosecution. And this is both an advantage, an appropriate form of remedy for a constitutional violation, and also a reminder that the third party custodian does not actually sustain the legal right to the remedy of importance. Much later, in the six unnamed narcotics agents against Bivens, the Supreme Court imagines a damages remedy to be available not to the party prosecuted, but to the party actually searched. Here, at least according to Chief Justice Berger, the point is that the prosecution may not happen after a particularly unacceptable or unreasonable form of search and seizure, but that there should nonetheless be remedy for the party aggrieved, who is assumed in the context of Bivens also to be the party who might have been prosecuted, thus concealing behind yet another layer the question of the relationship between the third party custodian and the constitutional right. This is, just to be clear about it, the first and most serious point of failure in the 21st century context. It is the relation between third parties and searches which is crucial in any effort to understand how to limit government's access to private information about people in the 21st century, at least so long as both the data economy and the other legal rules governing it make no effort to prevent third-party intelligence services like Alphabet and Facebook and Twitter and WeChat and Tencent and from collecting vast repertoires of information about citizen behavior, which can be addressed not by subpoena, not by warrant, but by subpoena. The mismatch between the form of activity known by the word search and the form in which the Fourth Amendment imagines the nature of the required restraint on government power and in which the exclusionary rule functions to provide some enforcement mechanism is extreme. The relationship between 18th century placiness and 21st century so-called searching and seizing, which we shall be spending all our time analyzing next week, emerges directly from an understanding of the first party, third party problem in the exclusionary rule from the get-go. But this, from the point of view of the framers, is not the problem. The collective action by merchants and their lawyers to resist the forms of searching and seizing specialized in by the customs officers of the late 18th century First British Empire was a happy story for American legislators. The collective action of the population of Boston, however much it may have inconvenienced Boston between 1774 and the loss and evacuation by the British troops of the so-called Revolutionary War, the collective action of Americans in their states to fight back against unreasonable thuggery by imperial government lies as a historical understanding shared by the First Congress and the ratifiers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They think that can be a legitimate form, not a legitimate, an effective form of resistance to unreasonable searching. The juries of New York City in the 1760s certainly gave them reason to think that every bit as much as the juries and population of Boston. But in the world in which we need a Fourth Amendment, that is, in a world of a government with sufficient resources that it doesn't need to conscript thuggery, it can pursue its own policing and it can knock on any door it wants and has the personnel, the powers, and the courts necessary for it, the relationship of the common third parties to the position of any individual potential defendant whose person, house, papers, or effects are being searched is rather thin and far-fetched. The exclusionary rule is, from the point of view of the 20th century American society, the only enforcement mechanism of significance in restraining the potential thuggery of search and seizure, and it works only to the extent that there are criminal prosecutions and only to the extent that evidence in those prosecutions is effectively excluded. This is the period in which the Fourth Amendment begins to be tested against the idea of surveillance rather than search and seizure. Surveillance in this context requires the telephone. And the telephone, that great late 19th century invention, becomes a potential source of evidence in criminal prosecution in the course of the early 20th century, and it is like Silverthorne Lumber and the other cases of the 20s where the interest of an enforcement operation growing out of the structure of prohibition, that is to say, an effort to criminalize products widely made, sold, bought, and used by the general population, it is in that context that the proposition of listening to telephone calls and arresting people and prosecuting them for what they've said becomes first of importance. And as we can see from the unsympathetic receipt of such a claim by Mr. Justice Holmes and colleagues in Silverthorne, the relationship between searching and seizing and surveillance is not immediate and apparent to the judges of the early 20th century. The placiness of the First Amendment and the thinginess of seizure is already a set of rails against broad application of the principle that the people have a right against unreasonable thuggery, and takes some time to overcome. Time, I mean, in an intellectual rather than a purely historical sense. Some space in which reasoning has to occur, in which the surveillance of communications is searching and seizing. This, too, however revolutionary MAP might be, is only a half a step within the domain of the Fourth Amendment. It's really the passage of wiretapping law by the United States Congress in the first Omnibus Crime Control Act of 1968 that gives us Title III and the statutory controls over eavesdropping by the federal government, which have fundamentally aligned, or at least pretended to align, purported to align, the Fourth Amendment with the principle of control of surveillance. Even in the mid-1980s, it was still possible for a Seventh Circuit judge, who happened to be Richard Posner, to conclude that there was an inherent right in the federal police to conduct video surveillance of locations by hidden video cameras. That Judge Posner thought that was provided for in the All Writs Act, that it was part of some mysterious inherent right in the federal courts to authorize what wasn't really a warranted search and seizure, but merely breaking into a room and putting a hidden video camera in the ceiling. Later, of course, the onward marching understanding that surveillance in that sense is searching and seizing, subject to some Fourth Amendment constraints, eroded away that easy judicial confidence. But we ought to recognize that the relationship between the 18th century language and the conduct of the forms of communication surveillance that became second nature and the most favored go-to tool of law enforcement throughout American society was in itself an intellectual stretch. We now confront not surveillance, but mass surveillance, a form of activity by government which has no actual relationship to surveillance, merely a game of words. And as we think about that, which we do primarily next week, we have to understand how deeply then the wrenching that has pulled the word search from the natural common sense meaning that 18th century legislators had, persons enter places with permission or with warrant, and there conduct a physical operation of turning things over and opening them up and looking for things, that's search, which requires both the physical presence and the physical limitation, the crossing of a boundary. You can see how deeply that understanding of the nature of search is embedded in all the legal thinking that surrounds it in the cases of, you know, binocular or helicopter surveillance of physical premises, like U.S. against Dow Chemical. In which the two-dimensional nature of the boundary lines on the map are regarded as the constitutional entities, of dispositive importance. If you fly over a thing and look down, you're not searching because there's no crossing in and looking around. To be sure, judges who prefer bright-line distinctions in this area, of which Nino Scalia is certainly an archetype, judges who prefer bright lines may occasionally discover that the bright line of entry isn't sufficiently good. Hence, for example, the question of the heat surveillance, the infrared inspection of the outside walls of a structure that would disclose grow lamps for marijuana cultivation within. The role of drugs in relation to the Fourth Amendment, the alcohol prohibition of the early 20th century and the marijuana prohibition of the late 20th century, have created a vast amounts of constitutional law about cars and containers and plain sight and all sorts of other elements of subordinate doctrine. But it's also important to recognize that the physicality of drugs, the leaf and the droplet, the dram, they affected the reinforcement of the 18th century forms of thinking. They made it easier to believe that the problem of unreasonable search and seizure occurs when physical things, drugs, are being sought or recognized, or their signs are being detected. The place-focused nature of the Fourth Amendment, the thing-focused nature of the understanding of what search and seizure are about, the relative indifference to the first-party, third-party nature of the individual whose right against unreasonable search and seizure is violated when some holding pen is searched. All of these elements arose in slow motion, if you like, from 17th century circumstances and 18th century constitutional law, prolonged over the traditional thinness of the core of available despotism and the separateness of the pre-Civil War American government from the conduct of state business in the still partially autonomous state governments. And only the incorporation of the Fourth Amendment in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, occurring long after all these other elements of the situation had fully condensed themselves into a cohabitation with the exclusionary rule, begins a process of reconsideration. Incorporation in MAP made every police search in the United States subject for the first time to a form of federal constitutional review. Incorporation in MAP meant, for the first time, that the conduct of state government activity no longer could be immunized against the Fourth Amendment's requirement and its exclusionary rule, either because it was a state authority which conducted the search and seizure, or because it was the state authority's gift of that evidence on a silver platter to the federal law enforcement authorities that made the prosecution possible. So from MAP, we begin a period in which the forces of law enforcement in the United States seek to restrain the bite of the exclusionary rule. They recover Judge Cardozo's typically obtuse comment that the criminal goes free because the constable blundered. Well, no, evidence is suppressed because it violates the integrity of the courts to use the fruit of the poison tree, the evidence either gathered unconstitutionally or unconstitutionally used to develop the evidence on which prosecution happens. Cardozo's comment, though it has been repeated ad infinitum or at least ad nauseum throughout my lifetime as a lawyer, never meant anything important because it ignored the issue upon which the entire constitutional structure was raised, which is that it's not about the criminal, it's about the system of justice and the society of which it is a part. But that became, both in my legal education, the moot court case upon which I was supposed to have cut my teeth as an appellate brief writer was Illinois against Gates, the first attempt to create a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule in the United States Supreme Court. And the life that I have subsequently led as a lawyer in America over the last third of a century, in which the real effort was to maintain the exclusionary rule in its strength against the breadth of its application introduced by MAP against Ohio, a fight which is what we could say was ultimately won to an extent. There's barely a criminal prosecution in the United States without a suppression motion, and on the other hand, lost in the sense that suppression motions that ought, in the clarity of the light of MAP and Weeks, to be maintained are instead not because of good faith or other forms of exception. That back and forth between an effective amendment supported by a rule of exclusion from evidence in prosecution and a less effective amendment nonetheless applying as a form of constitutional propriety across the entire width of law enforcement in society, the outcome of the development of the exclusionary rule through the 20th century, then meets in the 21st another extraordinary set of changes and circumstances. For all that MAP may be thought of as a revolution in policing, and it is, to which a counter-revolution in favor of policing then must occur, which it does, all of the elements of change set in motion by incorporation are small in magnitude compared to the changes in what it is that policing wants, from whom it gets it, and how. In the first years of the 21st century, I was at a conference somewhere talking to a senior FBI official. And we were having an edgy sort of conversation in which I was declaring that if the Bureau had spent less time on various forms of not very useful investigation in year 2000, and had spent a lot more time on trying to make sure that Florida elections were administered in a clean way, we would not have had a minority president of the United States, a thing which then seemed a minority vote president of the United States, I should say, which then seemed to me like a significant constitutional problem. We had no idea in 2002 that the president by a minority of the popular vote was going to become a frequent occurrence in 21st century America. But at any rate, I was ragging the FBI executive about the choices of the Bureau and the consequences to American democracy, and that was really just a warming up joke on the way to, and look at what you're doing now, even then, that is to say, in the turning American society inside out and searching for people without any significant constitutional limitation, all of which had, of course, occurred after September of 2001 in the rule of a president with less than a majority of the popular vote. And the FBI executive was having none of it. He said to me, "You must be kidding. The people I have at Quantico surveilling communications, all of them are 26 years old and they all have ponytails and they used to work at AOL and they would like nothing better than to find me crossing a line about anything. They would rat me out to the public and I would lose my job in a millisecond because they don't like me or what I do. They just take my salary. You should be worrying about the guys at Citibank." And he, of course, was not entirely incorrect. The really important point was that his bunch of ex-AOL employees at Quantico were really just there in order to facilitate the Bureau explaining how it got stuff, which ultimately it would otherwise have had to indicate it got in information trading with the Foreign Intelligence Service of the listeners in the United States, which wasn't allowed to listen at home, but certainly was aware that there were certain foreign parties who listened at home. Even then, federal listening by law enforcement was a kind of alibiing operation, and it was infinitely inferior in its effectiveness and breadth, let alone its absence of integrity. It was infinitely inferior to simply sending a subpoena to Google and asking for all the Gmail. Because that is what the process of search turned into. Search in the 21st century meaning of the word, which has swerved far enough from 18th century meaning to cause us a crisis in the Fourth Amendment, even if nothing else had happened. Search means sending administrative orders to non-police organizations to make copies of and transmit information collected on behalf of, perhaps, but certainly about, individuals who may be subject to criminal prosecution or who are the object of law enforcement investigation. Persons, houses, papers, and effects, as I said last time, can be understood to be an 18th century list amounting to identity, but it still doesn't mean that what is searched in the 18th century meaning of the term is an identity. What is searched is a place for a thing, specifically denominated in a warrant naming both the place and thing. Search, both in the context in which we use it when we search the web. We search now. We don't do research in universities, as you're aware, let alone in other parts of society. Search, that is, asking an intermediary party where information can be found, not research, finding information for oneself. Search is about identity as we conduct it most of the time. The things we are most likely to enter into search boxes on platforms are the names of people we are searching to find out, or at least we used to when we went out with people, who the people are we are about to go out with. The search is, in its first now primary meaning, as an activity in the world, about identity, about discovering the continuities that lie behind names and dates and places, the linking of one thing to another thing, the pulling of a chain by its most prominent link, allowing us to infer and to access in structures which hinge on who or what it is that we are searching for. And this, of course, is also what law enforcement means. It means not to look for the barrel of untaxed molasses or the knife with which the stabbing was done, although that still may happen to some extent. It means to turn a party inside out, to look for a connection between X and Y, to be aware of X in his banking and his buying and selling and his web searching and in all the other ways that X can become more explicable to the forces of order than if X were simply allowed, as Brandeis and Warren said of the right of privacy, to be let alone. It is that not being alone, being always the object of other scrutiny, which is the meaning of being searched in the 21st century, and the conveying of mixed leverage between the searcher and the search is the business of the platform. LinkedIn sends me every week a little email telling me how many times I was searched for in the course of the week and who was searching, which is amusing to me because my LinkedIn account is a purely empty listener to which I have never, since the date of its creation, logged in, and I am merely watching who the searchers are looking for without actually contributing anything other than information current about me in year whatever it was, 2007, to the search. But it is this, the balance of searching and being searched for, the nature of the penetration not of our premises but of our identity, which is crucial to the existence or non-existence of our constitutional right in the 21st century, and it is this to which the Fourth Amendment is, by its language, by its history, and by the mechanisms of its operation, ill-adapted. This, then, is where our crisis becomes acute, where we look to our constitutional regime to provide a protection it cannot provide, and we look to the intermediaries who are no longer warehouse keepers with barrels in the basement, but the platforms built on spying for their own purposes, connecting everybody to the parasite with the mind of God and keeping them engaged so that the parasite and its organs will have greater and greater completeness of behavioral information. Yes, of course, the cases then come to be about the phone, but only in the merest sense that the phone, a physical object capable of being breached in a near physical way with wires and contraptions and cloning machinery, is really a mere way station between the point of collection, which is us, no longer the agent but the object. You're not the user of Facebook, you're the product of Facebook. And the actual operation of collection, storage, analysis, and expression, which is the advertising business, let us say, and everything that lies underneath, around, and behind it, which is more spying. The privacy invasion contractors of the world are not the thugs anymore. Not government's agents, not the sneakers and the breakers in of a government whose secret police are out of control. The privacy invasion contractors of the present are the largest and most powerful private entities in the data economy. The social media companies, the search engine companies, the microblogging companies, and the telecoms whose wiring is now not merely that upon which banana clips could go in order to get a conversation for which an interception warrant has issued under Title III, but the wholesale spires on everything, and the merchandisers of our knowledge about ourselves and our secrets and the things we don't know about ourselves and might not consider secret if we did. And to them, all the rest is now merely ancillary. And for them, the Fourth Amendment offers neither significant reason to protect third parties, who are the first parties of the old, nor significant power restraint, since they are not the empire or its direct servants or its conscripted agents. They are merely the recipients of what began in equity as the order to testify, the subpoena, an administrative structure which the prosecutor can treat the way the doctor can treat a prescription pad, and which displaces all of the questions about freedom and autonomy to a question about administrative burden and expense by those who have no propriety in spying, because they have no principles to speak of, and are not the addressees of constitutional learning. This then puts us in the position in which we can consider the reshaping of everything that we have developed over the past 400 years for the purpose of protecting the rights of the people in a context in which the rights, the invasions, the parties, and the procedures have all changed out of recognition. As we shall see next week, no matter how deeply our ambitions run or how broadly we think ourselves committed to the task, we cannot do it. And we begin our investigation of the role of the Constitution amidst our computers and our shrinking privacy. We begin with a tragic failure. Talk to you soon.